We've heard about two famous scientists who didn't know any chemistry. We now have somebody who knows more chemistry than probably the whole audience put together, Jack Dunnett. Jack had the great fortune to be a friend of Sidney and Leslie Orgel in the good old days, and we'll now hear about it.
Well, thank you very much. Jim started up by, his first remark was about the failing memory of old men. And I would like to begin by reinforcing that idea that whereas we tend to forget the names of people who we know quite well, while at the same time, we can sometimes remember events in great detail that never happened. So, I haven't got any slides, I'm trusting my failing memory to tell you about some experiences that I had in the some 60 years ago. And in particular, I'm going to say something about visit that I made in early April 1953 from Oxford together with Dorothy Hodgkin, Leslie Orgel, Sidney Brenner, and Beryl Orton. And this visit was one of the first visits. I'll come to some questions about it. And on the 14th of February 2003, that's about 10 years ago, it so happened that Francis Crick, Leslie Orgel, Sidney Brenner, and I met for lunch in the Salk Institute, and we tried to recollect the events that had happened at that time only 50 years before. And the interesting thing was that we all remembered it differently. The largest discrepancies, as it turned out, some of the discrepancies were very minor things. One thing was, I went there convinced that our visit had been at the end of March. And I was persuaded finally by the other three that this could not be true and that it must have been the beginning of April. I can't remember the exact details of this, but I had to admit in the end that they were probably right. On the other hand, Sidney insisted, I had thought that the fifth member of our party was a postdoc called John Robertson, who had been at Dorothy's lab. And once again, Sidney said no. It was a girl, it was a woman called, and then when I went back to Zurich, I made some researches and found out that Sidney was correct, that the fifth person was Beryl Orton, who was a postdoc at that time in Dorothy's lab. So that's two to Sidney against none for me. But on the other hand, Sidney insisted that Dorothy Hodgkin was not present. And I knew that this could not possibly be the case because we traveled in Dorothy's car. None of us young people had a car. In those days, it wasn't an everyday thing. And I remember that I drove Dorothy's car from Oxford to Cambridge and back again. So that was one. And I mention these things to illustrate how these events, which had happened half a century before, had left completely different marks in our memory. Now, I want to say a few words about why did we get there? Now, I had spent the years 1948 to 1951 at Caltech. And I was a member of the Pauling research group, but at the same time, I had fairly close connections with people in the Delbrook group. And because of this double association, Pauling, Delbrook, I was aware that what was going on. I knew about Pauling's alpha helix. I was present at the day when he presented it with a theatrical motion and showed us the alpha helix, which, of course, the people in Cambridge had failed to recognize. I think the reason why they had failed is that the Cambridge people, being crystallographers, had considered only helices with integral numbers of units per turn. So they had thought 3, 4, 5, 6, and none of them worked. Whereas Pauling's starting bid was that the amide group is planar, so what can you do with that? And he had found the right answer, whereas Bragg and his group were extremely annoyed that they had missed this. At any rate, through my association at Caltech, I was aware when I returned to Oxford, I had been talking with these people about DNA and the secret of life and so forth. And there was no doubt in our minds that DNA was the compound to look at. I went back to Oxford then in 51, and in 52, late 52, I had been working with Leslie Orgel on structural chemical problems, and in the late 52, autumn of 52, the young South African Sydney Brenner arrived to work with Hinshut, to do a second PhD. No, he had a degree in medicine, and he wanted to do a PhD with Sir Cyril Hinshelwood. I met Sydney shortly after his arrival. He impressed me first as being a tremendous mimic, and he could imitate everybody in the Physical Chemistry Institute in Oxford, from the professors down to the students with whom he worked. He was absolutely marvelous. He also was a great reader. And we met with Leslie, Sydney and I, we met once or twice a week to talk about what's going on. And Sydney told us what was going on in the realm of DNA research. And Sydney told us in 52, late 52, about the Chargaff ratios. And we talked about them and wondered, what can possibly be the background of this? And I still think, if we had been smarter, then, and we had thought about it with greater clarity, then we might not have determined the structure of DNA, but we might have seen that this was the possible basis for a code. However, we were not smart enough to see that, but we were still interested. I knew Francis after I came back the first time from Caltech, partly through my visits to Cambridge to talk to Bill Cochran. And through Bill Cochran, I knew about the work on the helix, Vladimir Van's paper, which was sent to Cambridge to be reviewed and ended up having three authors, Van from Glasgow and Cochrane and Crick from Cambridge. So through that, Francis certainly knew about what the Fourier transform of a helix would make an X-ray picture look like. And when he saw then the pictures of Rosalind, it was immediately obvious to him what was going on. And in this, I think he had a tremendous advantage compared with other people who were possibly thinking about these problems. So Francis and I met occasionally and argued about all sorts of things. What is the best? Mostly we talked about protein structures. Is a protein structure easier to solve when it's got 12 molecules in the unit cell or with one molecule in the unit cell? Things like that. Anyway, one day then in March or April, probably the latter, we had a telephone call from Francis, and he told me that he thinks now, after all these false alarms, this time we've got the right structure, and why don't we come off that Dorothy and I should come over to see it. And I said, well, I have these young friends here who we talk about DNA. One is called Leslie Orgel and the other is called Sidney Brenner. May I bring them with? And he said, yes, of course. So the next day or the day after, we drove over, saw the structure. We knew enough about the problem to be instantly convinced of its essential correctness, and were tremendously impressed. I have a quote. We knew that this was for us a historic event, to be there to see this structure and be among the first people to see it. And I read terribly these days, so I have to try to. I don't think anybody could see in 1953 that during the next half century that biology, science was going to be industry, the industry was going to be completely transformed, that this was the beginning of a new world. And I copied down a quotation. Where is it? The quotation I'm going to read, it was originally written in German, but I'm going to read my English translation. At this place and on this day, a new epoch in the history of the world begins. And we shall be able to say that we were present at its beginnings. These words are from Goethe, written in September 20th, 1792. The occasion, we might think today, was, compared with the DNA story, a relatively laughable. What he was talking about was he witnessed the defeat of the Prussian army by the ragged French militia at the Battle of Valmy in 1792. Now, I think his sentence is a magnificent sentence, but I like it to apply it much more to that day in April 1953 than in 1793. If I've still got 1 minute more, the DNA structure did not appear from a magician's wand. In the Watson-Crick paper, they of course acknowledge various ideas which were necessary to present that structure, and I just made a brief list of scientific discoveries which were directed and essential steps to this 1953 event. One of them, of course, was Aspery's photographs of DNA fibers which had been made in the late 30s. A second one was Casperson's discovery that he could make DNA fibers which were immeasurably better than the sort of thing which people had been using before, because he could prepare fibers with molecular weights of several millions as against the rather broken up fragment that people had been using till then. The third thing was Signer's preparation of a super long sequences for DNA and his handing over of this material to Wilkins in, I think, 1951. Another thing happened in Cambridge, and that was the establishment by Dan Brown and Todd that the chain runs 3'5' on the ribose. Without knowing that definitely, one would have had innumerably more possibilities to contend with. The next step is the crystal structure of by Furberg, of the crystal structure of cytidine, and the paper he wrote a year later, which is in fact referred to in the Nature paper, where they say, we have adopted Furberg standard model number one. Furberg, on the basis of his cytidine work, had essentially proposed DNA, the fiber must be like this or like that. And one of those structures was adopted as the basis for the model making. The next thing was Vladimir Van's paper on the Fourier transform of a helix, which essentially had the effect of making Francis into an expert on this problem. And the last one was the publication by Chargaff, who you didn't like very much, but still, Chargaff made this enormously important discovery of that the amounts of adenine matched the amounts of thymine and cytosine and guanine. I think I've said enough, though I always forget things that I'm supposed to say. Maybe I've already forgotten. My reading is very bad, so I may have missed some things I want to talk, but I think I've talked long enough, and thank you very much for inviting me, and thank you for listening to me.